Thank you for that brief introduction. So I guess there's a reason we've been hearing a lot about the retina over the last few days. The retina as a neural circuit has been really a great place to study how information processing is connected to cellular mechanisms. One of the reasons is its accessibility. You can take it out of an animal essentially intact, and it will work pretty much, as far as we know, just like it does in the animal. It has a relatively simple organization, only five basic cell types, but there's enough complexity and there's enough interesting functions to tell us something interesting about how the nervous system computes. You've already seen this slide already. There's only five basic cell types, but there's more than 50 subtypes. In particular, a lot of diversity the further you go through the retina. I'm going to be focusing in general today about inhibitory neurons. Those are the most diverse in the retina, in particular the amacrid cells, as we heard yesterday from Jimmy Zhu. A very nice talk about one amacrid cell, a starburst amacrid cell, where the function is largely known. At least one function is largely known, its role in direction selectivity. But in general, for the more than 30 or 35 types of amacrid cells, we don't know what their specific functions are. There's a lot in common about the retina with other neural circuits in the brain. The diversity of interneurons. Interneurons are diverse both in the hippocampus and the cortex, and in most cases we also don't know what they do. Synchrony, as we heard about today from Elad, is also common in other parts of the nervous system. There's a layered organization in the retina, as we heard from Jimmy yesterday. So in this layer here, called the inner plexiform layer, signals run in separate channels, which in many cases can be seen as different information channels and different temporal channels. Retina faces similar constraints as other parts of the nervous system does, such as an efficient use of wiring, the necessity to operate in the presence of noise, limited dynamic range of its cells. Okay. So to talk about a bit about the experimental techniques that we use, you've heard about one of them from Elad today. We use a multi-electrode array. We take the retina intact out of either a salamander or a mouse, and we place it down flat on a 60-electrode array that records extracellular action potentials from ganglion cells. We stimulate the retina with a video monitor, so we can control, simply by controlling the pixels on a video monitor, all of its natural inputs. In this age of optically activated genetic tools, we activate our neural circuit using two genetically encoded, optically activated molecules, opsin and rhodopsin. Do it the old-fashioned way. So in addition to multi-electrode array recording, we also combine this with intracellular recording. So simultaneously, we can record from an interneuron, such as an amacrine cell. Here's an example you saw, very similar one from Elad with twice the number of extracellular ganglion cells, but one less important cell here. That's the recording from the interneuron intracellularly that's recorded simultaneously at the top. Using this configuration, we can also inject current into an individual interneuron, and that's important to perturb the circuit, to be able to ask the question of what are individual neurons actually doing to change the circuit, to change the spiking patterns, to change the receptive fields of ganglion cells. Recently, we've also combined these techniques with optical imaging to be able to access the population of interneurons more than just one in terms of recording. So I'll talk a little bit at the end about recent approaches doing two-photon imaging simultaneous with multi-electrode recording and also visual presentation of visual responses. Okay, so the topics that I will attempt to get through today are listed here. So I'm going to start off by looking at sort of a classical property of the of sensory neurons, the receptive field, the classical receptive field, also called the linear receptive field, and being able to measure the contribution of individual interneurons to that. Then I'll talk about inhibition, how it can be used to generate a more complicated feature, which I'll talk about, and also a new form of retinal short-term plasticity that we've discovered in the retina that we think is also generated by inhibition, and also at the end, as I mentioned, the combination of optical and electrical recording. So this is an old tenet of sensory neuroscience. In many cases, not only the visual system, but auditory system, somatosensory system, you find that there's a region that provides excitation and a peripheral region that provides an antagonism, here an antagonistic surround. So this has been known for more than 50 years in the retina. So models for this are also, there's fairly old models of how signals are conveyed through the central region and the surround. So this is a simple model. There's the surround. In general, the central time course is faster and the surround time course is slower. And so if you were to make a linear model of the receptive field, that would include both space and also time. And this can be passed through a simple threshold. And this is an approximation of a cell's response. There's much more complicated nonlinear things going on with ganglion cell responses that we can demonstrate. So why study this classical linear receptive field? And so you can think of it in a couple of different ways. If you give let's say a very broad random stimulus set like such as white noise, the linear receptive field is the average feature that precedes a spike. You can also think of this as the visual feature on average that a cell is most sensitive to. So that's the linear receptive field. There's many different types of nonlinearities. We heard from one yesterday, the direction selectivity that can be a contribution of the center and the surround. But what I'm just focusing on is this linear property here. Now, it's been long proposed that the linear receptive field might derive from two different sources. If this is a ganglion cell, this would be the center, and this is the surround. Signals might flow through horizontal cells, signals might flow through amacrine cells. But still, even now, we know that to some extent there's contribution from horizontal cells. We can block transmission pharmacologically going through the amacrine cell pathway, and we still see some surround surviving. But there's still not an agreement as to, for individual cells, what generates the linear surround. So recent papers from Dennis Stacey's lab in the primate concluding that the surround is primarily horizontal cells. Another recent paper in the salamander, it's generated both by horizontal amacrine cells. One difficulty with these studies is that they do rely heavily on pharmacology. And so if we had specific blockers for horizontal transmission, that could be fine, but we really don't. So you can block electrical synapses, block gap junctions, but amacrine cells also make gap junctions with each other. And also, if you want to ask the question of, well, what does one individual type of amacrine cell contribute to the linear surround? That's very, very difficult to do unless you have one specific amacrine cell that has a specific transmitter that's not used by other cells. So we have that with cholinergic amacrine cells, and so the nice experiments that Jimmy talked about yesterday, where you can selectively block transmission from one type of amacrine cells, are sort of unique. All of them either have GABA or glycine. They're split in some ratio, but you really can't pharmacologically selectively at this time manipulate one type of amacrine cell. Okay. So we've taken the approach of recording intracellularly from an interneuron, such as an amacrine cell or horizontal cell, and what we can do is inject current into such a cell, and we can see that we can produce significant effects that we can measure in a population of ganglion cells. So with this sort of organization, essentially we can do, if we're recording from 50 ganglion cells, 50 paired recordings at the same time, with one presynaptic cell and 50 postsynaptic cells. Here's an example of such a recording. This is activity in ganglion cells elicited by a randomly flickering checkerboard. Every couple of seconds we can give a brief pulse of current, and you can see that this activity generated visually is largely suppressed in many ganglion cells. There's a chunk of a firing rate that's taken out of the response of ganglion cells, whereas other nearby ganglion cells are not affected. So we should remember that in this type of experiment that we're not just focusing on monosynaptic connections, which is kind of a typical thing to do with a paired recording. Use fine pharmacology or nice optical techniques, as Jimmy talked about yesterday, to really say that this is a monosynaptic connection. But we really don't necessarily want to do that. We want to see the monosynaptic transmission. We want to see the polysynaptic transmission, electrical synapses, all the natural pathways that are active when the retina is operating normally. That's what we want to study. This particular one didn't seem to have spikes. Many of them do. Many cells spike. Some cells will spike and then their spikes will run down a little bit. So in general, we can do this with any types of amacrine cells. Some are less selective, and so they affect many nearby ganglion cells. Others are more selective and they select fewer ganglion cells. So this is a large one. This is in the range of physiological currents. So if you just voltage clamp and measure the range of currents coming in from a light stimulus, so it'll get up to a nanoamp. Yeah. So in general, we go under a nanoamp, 500, 750 picoamps. No. So this is a sharp microelectrode, right? So we're not voltage clamping here. We're injecting current, and there's certain things we can't do with a sharp microelectrode recording, but there's certain things we can do, such as record stably for a couple of hours, and the cells often don't run down in salamander. Just statistical dip in firing rate. This is mainly illustrative, and I'll show you other examples. And so we can do more fine statistical tests, because there's a lot of variability that's actually generated by the visual stimulus, and so it kind of makes it hard to see what a significant effect is. We can do other stimuli such as repeat the same visual stimulus again and again, and then sort of have a much finer statistical measure of what the effect is. This is more of an illustration just to say that we can get clear significant effects from injecting current into single cells, but other nearby cells are not affected, which we sort of expect from anatomy. I'll talk about timing very soon. That's variable. Okay, so. So what I'm going to talk about is a couple of different techniques, different approaches to use intracellular current injection to measure where the contribution to the linear surround is coming from in different interneurons. So to start off with, in general, one thing that you one standard technique rather is to measure the receptive field by correlating with a random stimulus such as white noise. So we can use temporal white noise, or we can use spatiotemporal white noise, where the individual regions are modulated independently. And by computing the spike triggered average, we can compute what you can think about as a temporal receptive field. So I'm showing in the reverse direction. So the cell would be sensitive on average to when the light intensity increased and then decreased, so this would be an off cell. So by showing in the reverse direction, this is equivalent to an estimate of the impulse response function. If you were to flash a light or deliver a photon, on average, the firing rate of this ganglion cell decreased and then increased. You can do the same thing with spatiotemporal stimulus. So here this is a line stimulus where then we can plot in space and in time the sensitivity of the cell to different regions in space. And so here this would be the center of the receptive field. This is again would be an off cell, and then you see the inhibitory, the antagonistic surround coming here, and there's also a longer component of the antagonistic surround that's in the center. So this is the time course of the surround that I'm going to be talking about here. And by spatially averaging over this region here, we can compute a time course of the surround. So you could. So you see some ganglion cells that do have asymmetric receptive fields. And right, so you're not going to see the strong nonlinearities that you do in the DS cells. That's right. And so we see some ganglion cells that have a direction selective receptive field. The on and the off have a little bit of a different time courses. So I mean, if you came to recognize what the receptive field of an on off DS cell, you could probably recognize it this way. But this is actually not a way to pull out these strong nonlinearities. So you'd want to use some directed stimuli like moving bars, and I'll talk about directed motion type stimuli. So I mean, in principle, if you carried on an experiment forever, you'd go through all possible stimuli. But in practice, you don't. And so although this is a good way to characterize a simple property such as linear filtering in space and in time, if you want to characterize more complex property, you really want to use targeted stimuli.
Is there a general way of saying if you wanted to get the response properties up second order to do this in an unbiased way?
Yeah, so you can do things. There are methods such as spike-triggered covariance, where you, instead of computing a spike-triggered average, you compute a covariance matrix of the stimuli that preceded a spike, and then you could look at you could get some sense of higher order terms. Haven't done that. My guess is that you'd see a strong nonlinearity that is suggestive of that. And it might not clearly be a DSL, but again, knowing what a DSL is and knowing what its spike-triggered covariance looks like, that would allow you to see, you'd be able to make a correspondence. Was that clear with my answer? Yeah. But if you didn't know it was a DSL, then you might not be able to say, given a particular stimulus, that's sort of the difficulty with the white noise stimuli. It's not necessarily predictive of more complex stimuli.
Isn't it true that this in some ways, knowing that you don't get a lot of the cell types that have no response, it makes that whole approach a bit suspect?
That's right. And I think it's worth saying, the reason I pointed out the reasons for the linear receptive field being significant is, if it's the stimulus that a cell is most sensitive to. Also, if you're going to decode a cell, decode a single cell, and you want to make an estimate of what just happened, what the linear receptive field is might be your best guess. But you probably do a lot better knowing what the nonlinearities are. And in terms of, what approach should we be taking to analyze cellular responses to complex inputs. Now, this is a good first order and simple thing to do, but my opinion is the simpler stimuli they use, you get simpler descriptions. And things like DSLs, I'll talk about another type of motion sensitive cell today, I'll talk about a different type of adaptation. It may not be the best way to do it. I don't have an unbiased way to do it. In general, the biggest progress has been from kind of hypothesis driven or kind of naturalistic stimuli that are chosen for experimenters' intuition. Those seem to have been the best gains. I agree with you that maybe this isn't the best thing to do to discover new phenomenon, but it's sort of a standard and a very useful thing to do for simpler properties of the cell. Because we can see differences in these receptive fields. We can see big ones and small ones and fast ones and slow ones. In some cases, we can make a correspondence to the responses of, for example, ganglion cells and bipolar cells. And so, it's definitely informative, right? Maybe not ideal. I guess the combination of informativeness and easiness makes it attractive. Okay, is that okay?
Yeah.
Is that okay for now? All right. No, it's, yeah. Yeah, no, it's a good. It should. I think the rest, a couple of other topics will sort of, reveal that this is not the best thing to do, but it's not a bad thing to do. And again, it's sort of a standard current question about what generates linear receptive fields, and so that's what I'm going to talk about.
It's like democracy.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's get to some other of those strong nonlinear responses, and then we can talk about that again, because I think you need to know what those are or what there's likely to be before you design stimuli that tend to bring those things out. So direction selectivity is one of them that we already know about, and we'll talk about more in a second. Okay. So if you pull out from an experiment like we just showed, the ganglion cells surround time course, and the question being is, where is that input coming from? Is it coming from horizontal cells, or is it coming from amacrine cells? So what we can do by recording from an amacrine cell is, first we can compute the cell's own impulse response, its own temporal receptive field. Here this is a spatiotemporal stimulus, and what I'm showing you is the average of this, the average time course of the cell over its receptive field. Okay, so. Sorry. So this is sensitivity, and it's not.
What do you measure?
Sorry?
Is it
Yeah, so no, that's the spike triggered average. Oh, sorry, of the membrane potential. Yeah, right. So this is done with membrane potential, and in general, we don't really distinguish between spikes and non-spikes in amacrine cells, and that's generally fine, right? Okay, so then by injecting current into an interneuron, we can inject now white noise current. Now we can measure the linear filter between the amacrine cell's output and ganglion cell spikes. So here you can think of this stimulus, even though the visual stimulus is going on at the same time, as an additional pixel that we're injecting directly into the circuit. And by correlating with that signal that we're adding in, we can now measure, now make a linear model of the amacrine cell's output. Okay, so here's such a transmission filter. So if you can think about this as the average response to a photon, this would be the average transmission, the average change in ganglion cell firing rate resulting from an ion flowing through the amacrine cell's membrane. And in general, there's no reason why these two need to be related. They're completely controlled by different things, the inputs and the outputs of the cell. And so now we can ask what happens when these two act together. Now, in a white noise analysis, and sort of in a paired recording way, injecting current into one cell and recording from another cell has been done some time ago in the retina in a series of experiments by Ken Naka. But it's the combination of these to actually be able to predict what's going to be the output coming into the ganglion cell that hasn't been done. So we can now ask the question of, in response to a flash of light, let's say a photon, what is the time course of the transmission that arrives to the ganglion cell? And since we're talking about a linear analysis here, that's very simple. We can just take this response function and convolve it with the output function and then make an estimate of what the time course of the transmission is.
You're assuming there is only one amacrine
cell. Well, we're not. So we're only injecting current into one amacrine cell, and others are active, certainly. But we can measure the contribution of this one. There may be others doing different things.
You know, but the bottom thing that you tried to reproduce, wasn't that measured by reverse correlation?
Right. So even if there's a population of amacrine cells, let's say, you know, they may all be contributing separate components. And in terms of what the prediction is, you know, it may be that some are building this down here, some are building this up here. One would build the first half, another one would build the second half. There's really no expectation as to what we could do, and different amacrine cells could be doing different things. Yes, that's right. So again, we're measuring a linear receptive field, and we want to measure the linear contribution from each cell. And we can measure when we go in here and perturb this cell, we can get a function and estimate what its linear contribution will be. And so again, we're sort of making linear estimates. And we see that the linear transmission of this cell, and I'll show you a summary, not on this slide, but later, matches very well with the time course of the ganglion cell surround. So now we can do the same thing with horizontal cells and put the electrode in horizontal cells and measure their linear receptive field, measure their transmission filter, which tends to be different, more biphasic, and also make a prediction as to the time course of the horizontal cell transmission. And once again, the horizontal cell transmission very well matches the ganglion cell receptive field surround. Sure. Membrane potential weighted average, right? So I use the term spike triggered average. So in fact, what we do is just the cross correlation function of the membrane potential with the light intensity. And so it's imagining that, you know, the membrane potential at each point in time is you know, just some weighted function, and then we weight that stimulus that came prior to that. Okay.
And
these
are 200 milliseconds.
Yeah, the linear filters run around 200 to 300. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Integration time 200 to 300 milliseconds, right?
And the transmission filter is also cross-correlated.
No, so that's the transmission filter is correlation between ganglion cell spikes and amacrine cell currents that we inject. So that's an independent current we inject.
And this is uniform white filter.
So it actually doesn't really matter. And so in these cases, it's lines, and we can just sort of average spatially over that. But we can also use uniform flicker to pull out the time course of the surround. We can use lines to spatially see where it is. But if we use full field, we can see a correspondence that the second biphasic peak in the ganglion cell receptive field is basically from the spatial surround. There's a question here. So the linear, I see, so in okay. So the that varies, and so for ganglion cells, it generally doesn't do very well. And so we need to, first of all, apply nonlinearity afterwards. And it can do fairly well at a fixed contrast. When we start to vary the contrast, it doesn't do fairly well. And so for a uniform field, it does quite well. For spatial stimuli, some cells it does well. Sometimes it doesn't do well. Again, we're sort of trying to approximate this classical receptive field. And the classical receptive field, you can compute for any stimulus, whether natural scenes, although it's more difficult to do so. And so so even if it's not fitting perfectly, then we can still make an approximation. And so that means if it doesn't fit perfectly, that there's other things, other nonlinear things, and we do know about them. I'll talk a little bit about one that this cell is certainly not accounting for. No, so the transmission filter is computed with the same stimulus, and so we're trying to take the operating the circuit as it's responding to the visual stimulus, and if you go to the dark or you lower the contrast, then things may certainly change. So we're using it. It's also getting right. So again, it's sort of right. So it's sort of like. As I said, additional pixel that we're injecting in. There's other pixels that are also getting summed together in the individual cell. But this one signal that we're putting in is independent of those. It's uncorrelated with those. Aaron? It's on a similar time scale. We haven't... we measure membrane time constants, and I haven't really said, can you account for it? But it's on a similar time scale. And but some are actually much longer than the membrane time constants, as I'll show you in a little while, in ways that we can't explain. Okay. So I mean, this gives us an indication that the timing of signals coming through one pathway or another pathway is very similar, and they get there at the same time. This isn't exactly a causal demonstration that transmission coming from one cell is actually building the receptive field surround of the ganglion cell. In some way, we'd like to be able to manipulate that, be able to sort of map the receptive field and change the way that it is by change the receptive field surround by injecting current into the cell. And so one thing that we can take advantage of is the fact that the retina is reproducible. Now, it's also noisy, and Elad earlier showed a very similar plot and said it was noisy. And it's sort of a matter of what you focus on. If you want to compare it to cortex, it's quite precise. Bursts of spikes occur in these very narrow windows of time, interspersed by very long intervals of silence. There is variability here. A lot of the variability is in the precise. Is in the number of spikes. The timing can vary a little bit in many cases, but on the time scale of the linear filter, a couple of hundred milliseconds or so, it's actually quite reproducible. Both the membrane potential of individual cells and ganglion cell spikes. So we can take advantage of that fact.
Can you just go through and generate that plot
for response to
the
Right, so the reproducibility, and so there are two superimposed traces of the amacrine cell membrane potential responding to the same random flicker stimulus. Each line here is a different trial, right? And this is the PSDH from those showing that there's these narrow time windows that it likes to fire, right? Okay. So because of this reproducibility, what we can do is we can perturb a cell in such a way that knowing what its response is, we can try and make its fluctuations bigger or smaller. I'll say how we do that. Okay, so first of all, we can apply a visual stimulus. Now we're using a uniform field visual stimulus here, but it's not really going to make a large difference. We've done some of these experiments with spatial stimuli as well. So first we can record a visual stimulus and respond, first we can apply a visual stimulus and record the response from an amacrine cell. So now what we'd like to do is we'd like to repeat the identical visual stimulus, and knowing that we're going to get almost the exact same fluctuations in membrane potential, we can inject a current, a timed current, that is designed to make the fluctuations bigger, the depolarizations more depolarized, and the hyperpolarizations more hyperpolarized. So we first measure the membrane time constant of the cell, and then we can deconvolve the voltage by that membrane time constant and generate a current that, when is filtered with the membrane time constant, we expect will add to the previously measured voltage and make the fluctuations larger. Now, being a sharp electrode, there's some limit to the precision that we can get, and we think the precision is probably on the order of the membrane time constant, maybe 10 or 20 milliseconds or so, but that's fine for these sort of 100 milliseconds or so windows of, or 50, 100 millisecond windows of the receptive field surround. So we can inject current that's designed to amplify the fluctuations of the cell. We can't really record the membrane potential while we're injecting current, but you know, on the idea that the current is getting filtered by the membrane time constant, we expect that this will happen. And now we record a new set of spikes, and then we can they vary from 10 to 20 milliseconds or so on that order. Maybe some are 30. So now we can inject. Now we can inject current just of the opposite sign, which is designed to diminish the fluctuations of the amacrine cell. We collect a new set of spikes, and then we can compare the receptive fields of ganglion cells in the two different conditions, or in the three different conditions. Okay. So here's a temporal receptive field of a ganglion cell, and so this component is from the center, this component is from the surround, and now we can inject amacrine cell, we can inject current to amplify the amacrine cell's output, and what we see is that the amplitude of the surround gets bigger, but the amplitude of the center doesn't really change. And so now I'm displaying these curves to show sensitivity. The way we do that is by computing a nonlinear function and keeping those nonlinear functions similar, so all the sensitivity is represented here in the amplitude of the filter. And so the amplitude of the surround gets bigger when you amplify the output of an individual amacrine cell. When we diminish the output of a amacrine cell, we see the surround gets smaller. Over a population of cells, comparing the height of this peak in amplified and diminished conditions, in all cases we see that the surround amplitude gets bigger when we amplify the output of the cell. So this is a clear causal demonstration that when we take the output of a single cell and make it larger or smaller, we can actually tweak the amplitude of the surround. So this is a causal demonstration that you know, an individual amacrine cell that we're injecting current into is actually contributing to the receptive field surround. I'm sorry? So here you can't really tell that spatially. This is, if we're calling this the component that is from the center, and this the component that's from the surround, and we can see that it is by looking at a spatial map, then the center component really doesn't seem to be affected. So now we should remember, we should. Yeah. Right. So these are all the cells in an experiment. So that's basically just a function of distance, which I'll show you in just a second. These cells are too far away to be affected. Nearly all of the nearby overlapping ones are affected. Peter, one last thing to your question. One component to measure is that the surround is actually in the center as well. And so this inhibitory timed component is affected spatially, basically wherever the amacrine cell is, and it's contributing its receptive field to the ganglion cell receptive field. If they're overlapping spatially, then it would actually change the center component to the surrounding component in the center. We can't actually tell from this. We don't know if it's going from bipolar cell, going on to bipolar cell terminals, or to the ganglion cell directly. We know it's going through some pathway. We've done other experiments where we can, I see. So actually, when you do a spatial map, you can see local changes being made. And that kind of does imply that the output of the cell is prior to spatial summation, right? The ganglion cell is integrating all of its inputs. If you can tweak an input and change one of them, it means that it's not postsynaptic after integration. It means that it's likely to be presynaptic. It could be on a dendrite if a dendrite if the dendrites are electrotonically separated. And so it does imply that it's prior to integration. And so one way to get that is certainly onto bipolar cell terminals. And if you want to consider that feed, it's hard to say whether that's feedback or not, because depending on whether this amacrin cell gets its input from that same bipolar cell that it's feeding back onto, then that would consider that feedback, but we don't really know from this. From this. We just know that it's prior to integration within the ganglion cell. So the amplification factor, so you mean of the current we inject. So we're injecting a certain standard deviation of current. We usually choose something like in the hundreds of picoamps range. And so since we're not actually measuring changes in voltage, we can't record when we inject current. So we don't really know fractionally relative to the actual fluctuations, how much we're changing it. So since we're sort of in the physiological range of currents, we don't think that we're going out of the physiological ranges of voltage. And so that's one of the reasons we compare between the two different conditions. We make it bigger and we make it smaller, and we see the change. We don't really know how much smaller it is. So we can't really do sort of a quantitative estimate, at least not until we think about these things further. Okay, so the so across many amacrine cells, we see that many nearby amacrine cells, we see these significant effects on the receptive field surround, and we can also see them with horizontal cells. What we see from the difference of the two types of cells is that the effects of amacrine cells are much more localized, whereas the effects of horizontal cells, this is distance versus a normalized just change in firing rate in the ganglion cell, although we can also make these sort of plots with the change in the surround amplitude, and they're very similar. The effect is much larger. So even though both horizontal cells and amacrine cells seem to be similarly timed to affect the receptive field surround, the amacrine cells are controlling the very nearby surround, and the horizontal cells are controlling a more distant surround. So by looking at other examples of many amacrine and ganglion cell pairs, but we saw that there was a range of them. We already knew that there would be a range in the amacrine cell visual filters. Some are faster here. So this is the peak of a histogram of the peak of the filters that I'm plotting. Some are faster, some are slower. Some ganglion cells are also faster, some are slower. But we also see that there's also quite a wide range of transmission filters, from something like, down to 10 milliseconds, up to 70 or 80 milliseconds. Here's an example of slow and fast transmission filters. But in all cases, what we find is that if we compare the peak of the amacrine cell transmission with the peak of the surround, they're very closely related to each other. And so, in fact, what we see, if we compare the amacrine cell visual delay with the amacrine cell transmission delay, is that they're anti-correlated. So here, this normalization means that we're normalizing by the time of the ganglion cell surround peak. So we're calling that 1. And what we see is that if the amacrine cell is slow, the transmission is fast. And if the amacrine cell transmission is if the amacrine cell visual response is fast, the transmission is slow. So what we see is that there's different transmissions, and we can also see different transmissions from a single cell and from a single class of ganglion cells. We can see different amacrine cells feeding into them and different transmissions. So what we see is that, sort of like runners in a race, that they start, one starts off fast and one starts off slow getting to the amacrine cell, and then after that, the slow one speeds up and the fast one slows down, and they get there essentially synchronously. So what we see is that we might expect that the slow and fast temporal channels would sort of be segregated, but we see this overlap. And what we see is for each ganglion cell, the signals are getting in there at the same time as the ganglion cell surround. So here, if we think about the case where there's slower slow and fast ganglion cells as measured by their filters, and slow and fast amacrine cells here, in space, horizontal cells are larger, amacrine cells are smaller. Again, so the naive expectation might be slow goes to slow and fast goes to fast. What we actually see is that both the horizontal cells go to all kinds of ganglion cells, and slow amacrine cells go both to slow ganglion cells and fast ganglion cells, and fast amacrine cells go both to slow and fast ganglion cells. So why have this organization? So one effect we see is just basically due to efficiency. So the function of the surround being to measure a baseline light intensity of the surrounding area, and by subtracting off the center, of course, you emphasize small changes in intensity. It's changes in intensity both in space and in time, and that allows you to essentially reduce the amount of output, since uniform regions of the visual world are common. By only emphasizing edges, you get to have a more efficient smaller output. So given that role. By using a large amount of detectors, essentially you can use all the inhibitory neurons to build up that surround, then you don't need many separate channels for each different types of ganglion cells. So if there's a dozen types of ganglion cells, you don't need a dozen different types of amacrine cells for each linear surround. You can essentially use all of them, all of the amacrine cells for all of the ganglion cells. And we see this for the linear transmission. Basically, anytime you see a linear transmission, it gets there at the same time, at the time of the receptive field surround. So one argument is just efficiency. We don't have a good sense of that. In general, there's sort of different layers of the retina. Those who have looked at them, peripheral layers tend to be faster, central layers tend to be more slow. So there's definitely this correspondence. Many of these amacrine cells that are actually connecting to these has this linear transmission are what are called diffuse amacrine cells. They span several levels in the retina. And so if different layers are different temporal channels, then those might be integrating over multiple temporal channels and also giving their output to multiple temporal channels as well. Yeah. So that's a good question. I haven't measured that. Right. Okay. So one argument is just efficiency. Another argument is diversity. That by having a different ratio, a different weighting of different amacrine cells to different ganglion cells, then you can build up different surrounds. So if you were just generated a surround from a horizontal cell, it would tend to be more uniform. But if you wanted a different spatial weighting, let's say for different ganglion cells, by having different amacrine cells of different sizes, you could build up a different different set of surrounds. Another argument, which I won't go into much detail, is one of adaptation. Amacrine cells are known to be plastic and adapt based on the recent statistics of the stimulus, for example, the contrast, in a way that horizontal cells don't. And so one possibility is that transmission from amacrine cells allows the surround to be adaptive. And there's other work in the retina from Marcus Meister's lab that I won't talk about, showing that ganglion cell receptive field shapes can change and adapt based on the recent history of what's being shown to them. For example, cells can become less sensitive to horizontal lines if you show them horizontal lines. Cells can become less sensitive to vertical lines if you show them vertical lines. And therefore, by having a plastic surround, you can essentially reduce the effect of strong correlations in the stimulus. And so, you know, that could be one reason to have the multitude of amacrine cells all feeding into the same linear surround. Okay. So, in summary here, taking a couple of different approaches, you know, we can. A key thing here is to be able to combine the measure of input and output in a model that gives us tells us what the cell's functional contribution is likely to be. So we did this for a linear input and a linear output, but there's no reason we can't do this for any other input, and we can either do a linear output or make a more complicated model of output. In addition to that, this sort of record and playback technique isn't tied to the linear receptive field at all. It's something that we can generally do in the retina to measure what the effect of an interneuron is for diverse for different types of stimuli. So for this particular question, we see that both horizontal and amacrine cells contribute to the surround. Their timing seems to be synchronized, and it allows the amacrine cells. We think that it allows the different inputs to the ganglion cells to be flexible and efficient and perhaps adaptive. So now this sort of contribution of the amacrine cell to the linear surround is kind of, you know, a basic first order measurement, but we we know that there are more complex nonlinear things that that go on. I'm going to talk about one of them now. I'm going to sort of go through it in a summarized way because this is published research. But talking to Mitra a couple of days ago, it seemed that there was interest there. So I was going to talk about one specific role of an amacrine cell in a fairly high level complex function. Okay, so that's illustrated here. It's known that animals are very good at detecting moving objects. The problem with that is that they're both fixational, they're both eye movements and real-world motion that contribute to the retinal image. So if you just look, if you look at an eye movement trace, this is from a human subject in a head-free viewing condition. There's actually a lot of random walk motion at about the width of the full moon. So these are called fixational eye movements. So even if you're fixating on an object and you think your retina is your vision is totally fixed, it's not. It's constantly moving around and drifting. So Peter, you asked about microsaccades earlier. There's a bit of a terminology issue. So this wouldn't be called microsaccades. So microsaccades are like tiny saccades, kind of ballistic movements that are likely under voluntary control. And that kind of varies in different species. And salamanders do have saccades as was mentioned, at much lower frequency. But these fixational sort of drift movements are very common across species and similar amplitude. And they're thought to be left over from the vestibular ocular reflex. So that tries to stabilize your gaze, but that's not perfect. So there's this constant residual random walk motion. So I think the average speed is a degree per second. So they're much higher than the threshold of motion that you can detect, both in amplitude and in speed. And so the question is, how do animals, including humans, detect motion of an object in the presence of this eye motion? So several years ago, a grad student in Marcus Meister's lab, Bence Olveski, approached this problem in a simple way by using a stimulus designed to kind of emulate an object moving in the presence of a background. So a central object or a peripheral background can be jittered with a random walk motion about having the statistics of eye movements. And these can either be jittered together or separately. If they're jittered separately, then this represents a case where an object is moving in the presence of a background. And if they're jittered together, this global motion represents the eye motion alone. And in this case, it was found that there's a class of ganglion cells, both in salamander and rabbit, that responds very sensitively to this differential motion over the receptive field, but is almost completely silenced in the case of global motion. So the motion over the receptive field center is exactly the same in the two cases, but if the two regions are incoherent, if they have a different trajectory, then there's a lot of firing. And if they are coherent, if they move together with the same trajectory, there's almost no firing. So these cells are sort of solving the problem of rejecting eye movements in the retina. Yet they maintain great sensitivity to objects that move differently from eye movements. So these are called object motion sensitive ganglion cells, and not all ganglion cells do this. There are specific classes of cells. In fact, the direction on-off direction selective ganglion cell in rabbit is one of these types of cells, but there's also one or two other object motion sensitive ganglion cells in salamander and in rabbit. Okay. Now, I'm going to summarize this rather than going through all the evidence of how we know what the circuit is. But here's a phenomenon, a fairly higher level computation that we can explain in terms of cells and synapses and in terms of a model. Okay.
So the uppercase, why does it correspond to object plus I? I thought, if something out there is moving, you see the whole thing moving together, right?
Well, so this would be the object here, and if that's sort of jittering with a random walk.
An object is different from the background,
right?
Right. But you can also see a whole background.
Right, so the background motion would be caused by eye movements, right? So the fixational...
You can add it to that actual...
Right. And so in other words, like take a steady drift and add it onto. Yeah. So we've done that experiment, and it looks basically the same. I mean, this is kind of a symmetric experiment because we just make a different random seed for the two regions. But if we just take a random drift and add it to background motion, we get the same result. It's the difference in trajectory that matters. Well, for this cell type, it doesn't. But there are many other cell types that respond perfectly well to both types of motion. And so, you know, that motion signal might be used for something. It's just that those cells can't tell whether motion is from an object or motion is from the eye. Right? Those are non-object sensitive cells. Well, okay, so there's definitely a surround suppression here, but it's not what we call the classical linear surround. And so this is a surround effect that you would really not easily find by a classic receptive field map. So in this way, Winfried Denk's point is completely illustrated that, you know, if you want to find something complicated as suppression from the background, it really helps to have this sort of targeted stimulus. And these cells have a perfectly normal looking receptive field, a linear receptive field, but you wouldn't find this unless you did this type of stimulus. They have a linear surround. The linear surround is basically within the circle, and the sort of a nonlinear suppressive surround, which I'll sort of describe in a minute, which goes probably out to the decays over I think the time scale, the spatial scale is like maybe 5 linear surrounds or so, and you know, might in fact go out all the way to the edge of the retina. So we can see that from a model. We can see that from a model. That'll basically answer the question, right? So you could imagine that these cells do something like measure motion vectors in different regions and subtract them, but they don't actually do this. This basically all works by timing. And the summary is that if the timing of input from the center and the background is the same, you get cancellation. But if the timing is different, you don't get cancellation. And so the way that works is that in a model of a ganglion cell where you take small subunits, each of which linearly filter the stimulus, and then you threshold them and combine them within a ganglion cell receptive field, what that does is make the ganglion cell's excitation. First of all, I'm not showing this here, but each of these receptive fields are biphasic, so they emphasize sort of transient change over time. So if something changes in any one of these subunits, the thresholding makes positive signals not cancel negative signals. You know, a fine grating moving in a linear cell, black would cancel white. But what this thresholding does, it makes if any region changes in any location, that in the right way, in the positive way, that signal gets through. And it also makes the cell not sensitive to the particular spatial pattern. So you can stimulate these cells with a large spatial frequency, a fine spatial frequency. What matters is the timing of change, the timing of motion. So that's the receptive field center. Then there's a type of amacrine cell called a polyaxonal amacrine cell that has a very similar receptive field property that we described as part of this circuit. So these cells have long axons that can span the entire retina in salamander. They have a small receptive field here shown in blue, but a very large output field. So this output field is generating this sort of nonlinear suppressive input. So both the excitation and inhibition are sort of very temporally sparse, and they depend on the specific motion trajectory. So what these receptive fields types do is convert a motion trajectory into kind of a temporal barcode. If the temporal barcode is identical in both regions, then you get cancellation between the two. And if the barcode is different, then the inhibition arrives at random times relative to the excitation, and you don't get cancellation. So we've also made a circuit model of this by identifying the bipolar cells that are part of the subunits, actually measuring the time courses of the receptive fields, and see that they correspond to this model. We can inject current into polyaxonal amacrine cells and see that they are really connected to the ganglion cells. We can see that the inhibition in bipolar cells is coming presynaptic. So we can build up the circuit that really, at each level, can be explained with a model. both in the bipolar cells and in the amacrine cells and in the ganglion cells. And essentially all of your questions as to, you know, what is the scale? Is it timing? You know, it's basically this model here where you take a linear spatiotemporal filtering and threshold it, and that's how the cell does the computation. Okay. So for this fairly high level computation, we can explain it in terms of these components. We can also assign a function to one of the amacrine cells. These amacrine cells with long axons have long been identified, but it wasn't really clear what their function should be. And it's really only when you think about the context of how these cells would operate in a natural condition that you can start to put the pieces of nonlinear subunits, which had also been known before, together with long axons and distant transmission, that you start to see how this might make sense in terms of function. I'm not sure who was first here. That's right. It's more like acceleration. Because there's a bit of a biphasic temporal, there's a biphasic kernel. It's more like acceleration, but that's right. You know, it's not really relative speed. You can actually take the object and jitter it anti-correlated with the background, and you'll still get perfect cancellation. But that's the situation that never happens in the real world. You don't have objects moving exactly anti-correlated with eye movements. I think maybe Peter was next. We've done natural scenes for the so probably the answer is no. So these cells respond the same way to natural scenes. They're still selective for differential motion, and we can feed a model feed the natural scenes through the model. But what this model doesn't have in it is different sources of adaptation. So the contrast and luminance of a striped grating is fixed, but natural scenes have local variations in luminance and contrast, and there's a couple of different stages of adaptation that aren't here. So in photoreceptors, you get light adaptation, and that's gonna change things. You're also gonna get contrast adaptation, basically at the inputs to ganglion cells, that would also change the response. So those pieces would need to be added to predict natural scenes. Yeah. So you mean just a flickering check without differential motion or with differential motion? Actually, don't know. Right. Fit this model with the differential motion selectivity, and does this explain, you know, a lot of the cell's response to something like white noise? I haven't done that.
Is there an intuitive way to understand why a nonlinearity there is after the input structure?
So mechanistically, that's what we see. Why put it there? What that would give you is potentially differential motion selectivity on a finer scale than the receptive field center, and so you might have one region that's differential motion could be detected in one region. So then you might get detection, let's say, of a moving edge at a finer scale. We haven't explicitly done that either in experiment or model, but that's what you might expect. Another thing I didn't talk about is that you see strong adaptation in these types of cells when objects start to move, and so you might actually get independent adaptation in these subunits, which we don't really know, and that could be another reason that you could sort of, if you have a lot of motion in one region of the receptive field, then you would adapt independently and not adapt the other subunits. Okay, so this is a more complicated feature that's generated by an amacrine cell in a way that we can explain what it's doing. Again, kind of an illustration that we do, although we want to know what the receptive field surrounds are, and the linear surrounds, we want to go beyond that. I'll end this section by showing an illusion, answering the question of as to whether or not we think that this is in primates. The pieces are in primates, the amacrine cells and nonlinear ganglion cells, but we don't really know if they hook up the same way to build this circuit. So there's an illusion that's known, that's generated by eye movement. So you probably see that the center region there doesn't seem to be fixed. It seems to be jittering a little bit. It jitters even more if your head is not fixed. Because horizontal eye movements are independent from in vertical and horizontal directions, when a, When the eye moves horizontally, you'd expect a strong excitation here, but not such a strong inhibition out here. And when the eye moves vertically, you'd see the opposite. So we don't really know that this is occurring in the retina, but this is consistent with this type of circuit that basically works on timing. So when you get motion in one direction, with a particular type of stimulus, you might not get perfect cancellation. So you can basically map out the time window of that inhibition, and it actually can be predicted by the amacrine cell membrane potential, so very, very nicely. So switching to sort of going from simple linear to more complicated nonlinear, and so now this is also more complicated over time adaptation. In general, we know that neurons have limited dynamic range, and in many cases, they're forced to convey a set of signals that greatly exceed that dynamic range. So a classic example of this is luminance adaptation. So if you consider that in a dark environment, the probability of encountering a certain light intensity is down on the lower end of the log scale. If you want to encode this distribution, it makes sense to have a response curve that matches that distribution of intensities. The formal principle of this, that you have the response curve should look like the integral of the distribution, was formalized by Simon Laughlin. So if you have the distribution change, for example, throughout the course of the day, then you should have the response curve change as well, or else the cell will saturate at its higher level and no signal will be transmitted. And in fact, that happens for both rods, and which will eventually saturate, and also for cones, so you get luminance adaptation. So a different type of adaptation can occur when, even at a fixed mean luminance, looking at different environments, high contrast and low contrast, if you switch from one environment to another, you have a decrease in the variance of the distribution, but you also have a steepening of the response curve. So this is called contrast adaptation. So, and it happens at the level of visual perception, and also happens at the level of the retina. And so in a low contrast environment, response curves of ganglion cells are steeper. In a high contrast environment, they're more shallow. This happens over multiple time scales. It happens both very quickly, but it also happens with a much longer integration time, seconds and tens of seconds. You can even see psychophysical effects up to exceeding an hour in humans. And so so you can see the slower effects in an experiment like this. So here a uniform flickering stimulus is shown at a fixed mean intensity, but the variance changes over time, low contrast, high contrast, low contrast, switching back and forth. In typical adapting types of ganglion cells, you see that when the contrast is high, the rate goes high, but then when the contrast goes back and then decays down, this is salamander, this is mouse, even though there's no label there. But when you switch back to low contrast, the firing rate drops way down, and in many cases, because of a lower sensitivity that persists due to the previous strong stimulus, the cells fall below threshold, and then it takes them some time to recover. So this poses somewhat of difficulty because, you know, it's useful to tune the response curve to a current stimulus distribution, but when the environment suddenly changes, if you're not able to quickly respond, then you can either fall below threshold or saturate, and this is common of what you see in many ganglion cells. So recently, a graduate student in my lab, David Kastner, found a different type of ganglion cell with a very, very different phenomenon that didn't seem to have this problem. So these cells, in response to a high contrast environment, they elevated their firing rate, but then when they transitioned back to a low contrast environment, there was a persistent higher level of activity that then decayed back down to baseline here. So you can see that, you know, switching from so you can see that once you apply a high contrast afterwards the firing rate is not lower, it's higher. So to characterize what the cells were actually doing in these different intervals of time, so what I'm showing you here is sort of the average firing rate, averaged over many different temporal sequences of the visual stimulus. And so I showed you earlier that if you give the same reproducible sequence, you can get firing rates up to maybe 100 hertz or so. But here what we're doing is we're averaging over many sequences to show what the average firing rate is. But then we can go in at these different intervals of time here, early after early at low contrast and late at low contrast here and here. And so for typical adapting cells, we can see that the thresholds of these cells are high, the sensitivity is low when you go back down to low contrast. That's because these cells have been adapted by high contrast. And then it then recovers to the new environment. And as the firing rate increases, the sensitivity increases. So here we see that this increase in firing rate and this decay is also paralleled by an increase in sensitivity. So early after low contrast, the threshold is low. You have an average increase in sensitivity. And then that decays over time as you then get a decrease in sensitivity. So we've called these cells sensitizing cells because of the analog to behavioral sensitization. So in behavioral sensitization, you might give an animal a strong or noxious stimulus, and then you find that afterwards its sensitivity is elevated. Likewise, you give a high contrast stimulus to a ganglion cell, and then afterwards you see that its sensitivity is elevated. These cells are different populations in the so those results were both in salamander and mouse. We see that these sensitizing cells are both in salamander and mouse. Looking more at the statistics in the salamander, we see that adapting cells and sensitizing cells are separate population. If you just compute this change in firing rate over time, you get this nice bimodal distribution. If you then look at the specific cell types, you can then take cells that you might classify as a fast off cell by their linear receptive fields. And if you group them by this more nonlinear property of adaptation, you see that that the cells are still very similar in their linear receptive fields. They're maybe a little bit different. Their spatial receptive fields overlap. The sensitizing cells tend to be a bit larger, but if you were just looking at these linear properties, these cells would look basically like a continuum. But if you look at, but if you split them apart, given their adaptive properties, what you see if you look at nearest neighbor distances for the mixed population, you see that some are very close to each other within a receptive field center diameter. This one is a receptive field center diameter. Whereas if you split the cells apart into adapting and sensitizing populations, you see that the adapting cells form a nice mosaic. They don't have cells right next to each other, and the sensitizing cells are also spatially segregated from each other. So this is an example where there's a split in the cell type. Again, as Winfried alluded to earlier, if you just look at their linear properties, you don't see this. But if you look at their more non-linear adaptive properties, they split apart into separate cells. Okay. So now we've considered what the role of sensitizing cells are, and there's a couple of different ways that we think about it. One is in terms of, so this one was depending on the pace. And so talk briefly about this. So one of these ways you can see with this sort of experiment. So if you look at the population of these adapting and sensitizing cells of a single functional type, so these are the what we call fast off cells, but you can see that their timing of firing is very similar. If you let them go close to steady state late after you go to low contrast, they fire almost at identical times. But just looking at the transition to low contrast, because the adapting cells are falling below threshold, they're not firing, whereas the sensitizing cells elevate their firing. And so at the times of these common firing events, sensitizing cells increase their firing and adapting cells decrease their firing. So what we think is that these two cells are pursuing a different adaptive strategies basically to compensate for each other. So the adapting cells basically, because they have this residual effect, they've tuned their thresholds to the previous strong stimuli and they're vulnerable to fall below threshold. Sensitizing cells having an opposite type of plasticity essentially compensate for the lack of information that you see in the other population. And we see both adapting and sensitizing cells for different functional types. So we also see the compensation go the reverse way. So sensitizing cells have a much lower threshold here. And at the transition from low contrast to high contrast, sensitizing cells will saturate and the adapting cells won't. So with the reverse transition, when the strength of the signal increases, the different thresholds of the cells also specialize them in a certain type of signal. So the sensitizing cells having low thresholds encode weak signals, and their adaptive properties are such that when the contrast drops, they sensitize to encode those weak signals. And the adapting cells, with their high thresholds, they don't saturate, and they specialize in encoding in strong signals. So with their transition from low to high contrast, sensitizing cells saturate, and then adapting cells convey the bulk of the bulk of the information. So the classic version of this problem, where if you take a stimulus distribution, the thing that you should do if you have maybe one cell encoding that stimulus distribution is make the response curve look like the integral of that distribution. And this makes sense for something like a fly visual system, where this rule was first formalized, where you may only have one neuron encoding a distribution. But for a system where you have multiple neurons, then you can have different neurons with different thresholds and different forms of plasticity break this distribution up so that you lose one end. One type of cell specializes in one end and specializes in not failing to encode that end of the distribution, whereas the adapting cell specializes in the other end and specializes in not failing to encode that end of the distribution. They are different numbers. There's about 20% of the cells in salamander. And the numbers seem to roughly go with their receptive field sizes. So the rule, yeah, exactly, they tile, so you get less of them, right?
Does that match up with the frequency of going from the frequency of changes in terms of high contrast and low contrast environment?
So in a natural scene, so the natural scene statistics would be complicated because you'd have to combine animal motion to that. And I think what might really matter is things like sharp drops. You'd expect the transitions to be symmetrical, right? You should go up as much as you go down. But you know, depending on if the down drops are sharp and the up drops are sharp, then that could actually make a difference. And so we haven't done that, and I would speculate that I'm not sure how satisfying the answer would be. What we think of really is as to the cell types, is that, and their correspondence with the different roles, is that sensitizing cells are a little bit more integrating both in time, but they also have a weaker surround. And that fits with the idea of conveying weak signals. So, you know, at low luminance, receptive fields are larger, surrounds are weaker. If these cells are specialized in conveying weak signals, they also have weaker surrounds, both temporally and spatially, and larger receptive fields, spatially. Okay. Any questions about this is not published. No. I hope so. One attempt, still trying. But that is the plan. Yes, run. Well, interesting question. The two sides seem to be important. We want to have one adapting positively and the other one sensitizing. And so could you also have cells in the middle? I don't see why you couldn't. There may be a space argument, right? The more different cell types you have, there's certain real estate, then if each of these cells have to be cells are a similar class and have to be duplicated across the entire retina, then there could be a space argument. But you know, if space is less available, then I would say maybe you don't. And so these cells, there are other ways that I won't get into that these cells convey different information. One of them adapts much more completely, and so it fails to convey information about the contrast level, and the other one adapts less completely. And so the more sort of different variations you have, if you had sort of very sensitizing cells, and adapting and very adapting, then you sort of get more more samples of different types of the stimulus, and so you could have an advantage. And where the trade-off for optimality works, I'm not sure. I'm sorry. So spike timing plasticity. No. We have a model. I'll talk about that in a minute. But
but
yeah, we expect. The quick summary is that we think that there's two different adapting pathways, and that basically you get adaptation of inhibition that generates that. And so other experiments we've made some detailed models of adaptation, and that can give a sense of what the individual adapting pathways are. But one goal is to look at the look at which cells are actually doing it, and so we don't really know yet. So another way to think about sensitization is sort of a single cell role in the information it's conveying by having this delayed increase in firing. And so to think about a natural context, what we did was to consider that high and low contrast may often be high and low spatiotemporal contrast. And one source of that would be motion, as you've already talked about. So there are two important sources of motion on the retina. One is eye movement, in particular fixational eye movements that we've talked about. And those tend to be sort of small jitter type motion, which would convey sort of a lower spatiotemporal contrast. You can think of it as a low spatiotemporal contrast. But in comparison to object motion, which can be a much higher spatiotemporal contrast, if an object is moving quickly, quickly it would generate a very strong input. So we consider the case where high contrast is generated by fast object motion and low contrast is generated by fixational eye movements. Further, we considered the case where, just trying to focus on the different properties of motion, that we kept the statistics of the object and the background the same, similar to the stripes that we saw before, but a little bit more varied. So essentially, that example is the case of camouflage. So here, considering an object, which is a flatfish of the Monterey Aquarium, the statistics of the object in the background are very similar, and when the object moves, it becomes a much more apparent stimulus. But when it stops, you still get motion, and that's indicated by the jittering camera work. And so then you have these transitions between fast object motion and slow background motion, and we ask the question of how do a population of sensitizing cells correspond to this sort of stimulus. Okay, so here's the one-dimensional version of the stimulus that we used. We have background motion and moving in a random walk, and then we have an object that every few seconds moves briefly, and the object and the background have the exact same statistics. So when the object is moving coherently with the background, it's effectively invisible, unless you've memorized where it is. So what we've done is to present this stimulus at multiple locations on the retina, and for each presentation, then we can go back and collect the population of sensitizing cells, how it was activated and how it fired, and spatially relative to the stimulus and at some time afterwards. Okay, so here's the stimulus in space and time. Here's a spatial cross section of those bars, and here's a jittering random walk showing background fixational eye movements. Here's the fast motion, which only lasts a couple of hundred milliseconds. And that occurs every 5 or 10 seconds. And then again, by presenting this object at many different locations, we can make a similar map relative to the object. If we call the location of the object 0, what were different sensitizing cells doing in their firing rate, both when the object moved and then over time. And here's a map and firing rate of such a population response. And so 0 is the location of the object when it moves. You can see that it makes a very strong response to the motion, and the response persists a little bit after the integration time of a couple hundred milliseconds or so. But then you have this activity that persists for several times longer than the integration time, and it's localized mainly in the sensitizing cells that were underneath the object. So if you can take a cross section of this plot in this interval of time early and this interval of time late, and you see that the population of sensitizing cells, because they've elevated their sensitivity, are elevating their activity only at the location where the object moved. So effectively, sensitization is acting sort of a form of short-term information storage. So even though the immediate stimulus is gone, there's this persistent sensitivity that's storing for some time afterwards the prior location of the object. And let me finish the thought and then I'll take the question. Prior location of the object. So if you think that in general in the real world, if an object moves and then stops moving, it's not going to disappear, it's in fact still where it was, then the elevated activity is forming a prediction as to where a future stimulus would be. If an object moves and then stops, there's likely going to be a stimulus in that location in the future. And so by elevating their sensitivity, the sensitizing cells are making a prediction that something interesting is going to happen in that region in the near future. Question? Yeah, they are. Right, that's right. It's actually more complicated than that. And I wasn't going into these details too much, but there's a spatial localization of adaptation and sensitization. Even adapting cells will adapt in the center and sensitize in their surround. So adapting cells will adapt in this region and they will sensitize in the peripheral region, sort of indicating where the edges of a cell might be, also making sort of a prediction that if an object might move peripherally, then those cells will in that location. More sensitive, but I don't have that slide for you. Yeah. So essentially, that's the all of this firing, although you can't see it here, is not just sort of a delayed activity. So if you shut off the stimulus here, you wouldn't get a response. And so we basically see that explicitly from our high low contrast experiments. It's easier to do with a uniform receptive field, although we can certainly do it here as well, to map out a response curve. So we can see that the response curve, when we do the full field high low stimulus, that the nearby cells are actually elevating their sensitivity. That's right. It's not just an increased activity. It's an increased sensitivity. So many have been done. That's certainly possible. Yeah. Right. I don't know. That would be interesting to know psychophysically, because if, for example, you were to just sum the effects, that's one way we think about the cells trading off. If you lose information in one and put it in the other, then if you sum them, then you may not see a net effect. There are different numbers, but you could just amplify one relative to the other. And so you could get something else out of these cells that you wouldn't see in sort of a flat line. So you could make use of it, whether or not an animal makes use of it, I don't know. Right. Right. So we think of this as another duality in this way. The on and the off pathway being a primary one. Rods and cones being two detectors at different luminances. That sort of duality. And so this is a third duality. In some higher order. Right. So the dualities are sort of increasing in their kind of nonlinearity and time dependence. From rods and cones splitting up is just the light intensity. On and off is at a fixed light intensity, you split the distribution in half, you take the different signs. And so this is taking into account time. It's taking into account the transition, going from high to low versus low to high. So an additional duality, looking at some sort of temporal, more complex temporal pattern. At some point, you may not think that, so here's a duality. In terms of adaptation, it's a similar sort of duality from this, but some ganglion cells in the retina adapt to patterns. I briefly alluded to that, which is that if you show them a strong stimulus, such as flickering vertical lines, they'll become less sensitive to vertical lines. And so they'll essentially adapt based on the strong stimulus. So you can as well think of pattern sensitization sort of in this correlated way. If you showed vertical lines, you might become more sensitive to vertical lines. Okay, so why would that be good, and why would that happen? So in the In the typical case, such as the strong stimulus that might potentially saturate a cell, you probably want to adapt to it and probably want to reduce the sensitivity. If you might think of weak stimuli, so you're looking for basically any measurement that you can get, stimuli are very noisy. If you can pick up the fact that there's a correlation and you could essentially tune your receptive field to that dominant correlation, then you could measure what that thing is better. So in a very noisy case, you might expect there would be pattern sensitization. That's kind of made up. We've actually looked for that a little bit and haven't found it yet, but that could be a sort of another higher order duality that depending on, in that case, the noise level, if you have a very strong correlation, you want to get rid of it, but if you have a very weak, noisy signal, sort of like the duality that Elad was talking about, a switch from redundancy to decorrelation. Instead of decorrelating, you might want to emphasize a correlation. Yeah, so in a simple way, you definitely have that. The linear receptive fields, stepping back to the simpler measures, linear receptive fields are different. You have monophasic and biphasic in time, and you have monophasic and biphasic in space, and you sort of have different sizes of receptive fields. I don't think of that necessarily as a duality, but a multiplicity. There's kind of many different detectors, and we don't really know, why there are many different detectors, different channels. Okay, so... I think I'm gonna 10. Okay, that's about what I hope to do. I will gloss over this a little bit to just say that sensitization requires GABAergic inhibition. So if you switch from low to contrast, high to low contrast, you see a decay. That's sensitization. If you block with GABA, you see an adapting response. That then recovers when you remove the picrotoxin. If you just compute a ratio of firing rates over time, you switch from sensitizing to adapting in a population of cells. Adapting cells don't really seem to change so much. So we think that there's an inhibitory pathway that's responsible for sensitization. One simple way, we have more complex models of how this would work, is shown here. So this is sort of a two-pathway model, where you have the two pathways doing the same thing, except one pathway is inhibitory. I'm not showing you linear filters at the beginning, I'm only showing you the thresholds. And so here, if you have a threshold, and then this symbol here is just meant to show adaptation. So you integrate over a previous history of 4 or 5 seconds, and then you drop the gain based on your recent history. That's what you typically think about as adaptation here. So now, at this level here, what this pathway, inhibitory pathway, would do is just decay at high contrast and recover at low contrast. If you have a function that then thresholds the output of this inhibitory pathway, then you would see a thresholded version here. What this is going to tend to do is emphasize the drop in output due to the drop in contrast. So then if you subtract that, what then you get is a bump that occurs. Basically, the strong high contrast stimulus is adapting away the inhibition so that when you go back down to low contrast, you see a disinhibition that then elevates activity. Then at the final stage in the sort of direct excitatory pathway, if you then get additional adaptation, that will have you adapt somewhat at high contrast, and also you see the sensitizing bump at low contrast. So the sum... They don't. And so this could have independent time courses. And we fit more detailed models that have the two time courses, and their parameters are somewhat different. But they are different, right? And so the time constant of the inhibitory adaptation we expect would dominate that, although we don't have an easy way to directly measure what that is, because we think adaptation may happen at output synapses of amacrine cells, or even output synapses at intervening bipolar cells. So the summary of this model is that we think we can get this sensitization as effectively negative adaptation in an inhibitory pathway. Right. So adaptation in the direct pathway we think is likely to be happening at the terminals of bipolar cells.
Well, it doesn't require
Yeah, so adaptation doesn't require inhibition, right? So this adaptation, we think, is this not being an inhibitory pathway here, this likely being negative feedback, either vesicle depletion or inactivation or desensitization. Most likely, vesicle depletion is the leading candidate. But so really, it's just one type of adapting inhibition that we're looking for. So the decay in sensitization is maybe it's kind of dependent on the input, but it can get up to 4 or 5 seconds. This one can be longer. So these experiments are not done in a way where you can easily make a correspondence to, you know, isolated bipolar cell terminals with sort of large voltage pulses. Don't necessarily clearly translate to these. One thing that I didn't have a chance to talk about today is a way to link adaptation with biophysical mechanisms using a model that will actually give you rate constants for an adapting kinetic system that, you know, somebody could actually use to make a correspondence. And we can model adaptation very, very well with those sorts of models, and so that it's something that we're interested in doing, but we don't really have a correspondence yet. So in the last few minutes, I wanted to talk about new techniques we've developed that would help us to look for interneurons doing things, such as amacrine cells producing sensitization. And so that's the goal illustrated here, which is that we'd like to activate the whole photoreceptor population using a visual stimulus, but we'd also like to record optically from the interneuron population, and we like to record electrically from the ganglion cell population, and we'd like to do that all at the same time. So illustration of a setup we used to do this, similar to other two-photon setups that we've that have been used, such as Winfried and Peter Detweiler and Tom Euler has used to record from the retina. But the ingredient mainly that we're adding is the multi-electrode array. So we project the visual stimulus down onto the retina, and we record both above and below optically. Getting this to actually work is kind of, you know, a problem in diplomacy, because there can be interactions between multiple elements here. So certain things we already know about, even the two photon, so even an infrared laser, 950 nanometers or so, can activate photoreceptors somewhat. So we keep the scan rate high and we measure cone responses. We need to separate the visual stimulus with two-photon imaging with appropriate filters. The laser can also generate a photoelectric artifact on the array, because the conductive traces are transparent. They're ITO, and so we don't get a photoelectric artifact there, but we do get an artifact from the electrodes. And so, fortunately, it doesn't saturate the amplifier, so we can either ignore those electrodes, or conceivably we can subtract it out. We haven't really done that as of yet. The laser can damage the array. We don't do that. And the semi-transparent array, it's a thin array on a cover slip, doesn't really affect the two-photon imaging. We can get decent images. So I don't have a chance to talk too much about about different techniques. We don't really have too much science that's come out of this, but we just have a demonstration of techniques. And so I'll talk about an approach that's not such a widely used one. We can inject calcium dye into individual cells and measure their processes through the multi-electrode array. That works. We can also bulk load cells with a calcium dye. There's some selectivity of loading that's not so desirable, but that also works. But I'm going to briefly mention a technique called second harmonic generation imaging, which we've been able to use for a population measurement of activity. So you're likely familiar with fluorescence, where a photon is a photon or two is absorbed, and then you have a shift in wavelength, and then you have an emission. So if you change the illumination wavelength, the fluorescence output won't really change in spectrum too much, but it will change in amplitude. With second harmonic generation, what happens is two photons are effectively combined into a single photon that's then scattered. It's not an absorption and a re-emission. It's a scattering phenomenon where what you get is exactly half the wavelength of the of the wavelength you put in. So if you change the wavelength like this, then you get a SHG signal that varies in wavelength also. The bulk of the signal is in the forward direction, so we collect from the other side of the retina. It's transparent tissue, so that's very useful for that. The way we actually get a voltage signal is through the application of a dye. SHG is mainly generated by regions of anisotropy, so things like muscle fibers generate very good SHG signals. One desirable aspect of this is that the dye we can use loads very easily to the into cells. The standard dye, such as FM464, that's been, for example, used widely to measure vesicle recycling. The one advantage of that is that the cells tolerate this dye very well. So traditional voltage-sensitive dyes tend to have some pharmacological effect, or they can have some photodynamic damage. But we can record for probably gone 10 or 20 minutes without really any indication of rundown. So the way that you actually get a voltage signal is that the electric field of a laser interacts with the dipole of the dye. So when the membrane depolarizes, the dipole strength goes down and the SHG signal goes down. And when the membrane is hyperpolarized, the SHG signal is larger. So here's just a static image of a field of cells in the amacrine cell layer, and so the membranes kind of all run together. So it's a bit of a sorting issue to identify one set of pixels to one cell. There's some issues about that may actually be helpful. Other people who have done sort of bulk loading get the indication that if you have two sorts of if you have two membranes that are right up against each other. The report is that they may actually reduce the signal because you have a cancellation of the sort of the two dipoles in the two different locations. So we may actually get a diminishing of a signal in the place that we don't want it, where it's the most complicated. And so if there's some separation of the membranes, then if the signal is greater there, then that would be helpful. Even if there is sort of overlap in individual pixels, potentially we can do some unmixing of the signals, sort of like what Iran has done in cerebellum in Mark Schnitzer's lab. But we can record optical signals that are noisy, but look like we should, like we expect them to do. So these are all average responses. So this is a response of an on-off amacrine cell to a flashing light, response of a moving bar. We can map receptive fields by correlating the signal with the visual stimulus. A lot of the measurements that we do make, such as receptive fields, field maps, because we can average over time, then the signals get to the level of signal to noise ratio that is acceptable to us. So in addition to measuring visual responses of interneurons, what we also want to focus on is correlations, because what we'd like to do is find a population of ganglion cells, record from a population of ganglion cells and a population of amacrine cells, and identify the different amacrine cells that are correlated with the different types of ganglion cells. In the situation I talked about today, we'd like to find an amacrine cell whose response is correlated with the sensitizing ganglion cells, but not the adapting ganglion cells. So we can map a receptive field optically of an amacrine cell, and we can find, this is the red circle of the amacrine cell, that if we compare its signal to nearby ganglion cells, that ganglion cells that it's very close to tend to be correlated with the amacrine cell. This is the spike-triggered average of the optical signal, and cells that are far away, you get a weaker correlation. From individual ganglion cells, we can record. So this is a single ganglion cell and a spike-triggered average of multiple optically recording cells, and we see sort of like we expect. We see differences. Some amacrine cells hyperpolarize. Much earlier than a ganglion cell spike, some hyperpolarize at the same time. There's correlations and anti-correlations, which is all what we expect given the diversity of amacrine cell types. These qualitatively look very similar to the correlations we can see if we're doing an electrical recording from an amacrine cell and an electrical recording from a ganglion cell. And then finally, we can go back and find which amacrine cells are correlated with individual ganglion cells, and then we can look at their visual responses. In other words, for a single amacrine cell, what do the visual responses look like of the set of amacrine cells that are correlated with it? And we also see a diversity there, that there can be fast and slow amacrine cells that are correlated with a single ganglion cell and monophasic and biphasic amacrine cells. So we think that the real promise of this will be when we choose stimuli where you don't necessarily expect correlations between interneurons and ganglion cells. So for example, flashes might be not the stimulus to use because everything will tend to be correlated, but more complex stimuli, you know, fine moving gratings, stimuli that change in contrast over time, those are the ones that we think will bring out the correlations that will identify cells of interest. And then, you know, we'd like to then stick electrodes them in the amacrine cells afterwards, and that's certainly doable. But first will be a characterization of the visual responses, and then moving on to perturbation with electrodes. And I'll stop there. Mike Mentz built the two photon setup. Mihai Manu, a postdoc who's now going back to his residency in neurosurgery, did the fairly complicated experiments of current injection and multi-electrode recording, and David Kastner built studied the sensitization sensitizing cells. I'll stop there. That's a great question. I think it's completely underexplored. The level of clinical tests that are done are very, very complete, are extremely crude. You know, loss of peripheral vision, night blindness, these sort of subtle features that you might expect. I don't think clinically people know really anything about. They don't study. It might have to go, you know, I mean, so one approach would be to sort of design psychophysical tests to pull out. So for example, the polyaxonal amacrine cells, you'd expect a loss of motion sensitivity, a loss of fine motion sensitivity. Probably you could still see large moving objects that move faster than the fixational eye movements, you could still pick up. When you get to very fine motion detection, you'd expect that to break down. As far as I know, there's no clinical test that actually pulls that out. That's the sort of thing that you may want to screen a population of people. If it's a genetic disease, then you may have to screen a lot of people to actually find find such an effect. The other way would be to just, you know, do genetics, look for mutations, and then afterwards look to see if there's any visual defects. Problem with that is that, for example, molecular markers are not known for lots of amacrine cells that will tend to change over time, and so then that might make that direction a little bit more more feasible. I agree that you know, we look at all these functions that are very detailed, very, very fine, but the visual field tests are very in a different realm. I think it's basically because people can function without a lot of their vision. You know, you need to not bump into something. You pointing a car in the right direction is and reading is good enough for most people. Yeah, good question. No, we haven't done that. We see sort of like Winfred asked earlier. We can see some cells with direction selective linear receptive fields, and so we predict that those might not be the on-off cells. They may be sort of like a non-on-off, either on or off cell analog. We don't really study that too much. So certainly, direction-selective cells have been described in salamander and in frog and in turtle. And so we haven't studied them too much. Oh, so how do we get an identification of the cell, or? I see, right, how do we split it apart? We may not be splitting perfectly. The signals that we get, and some cells give stronger signals, some cells give weaker signals. Basically, we can do a cross correlation and see if essentially kind of an identification of signal. What are the pixels that are correlated in a certain region, and we kind of pull out things together. If there's a and it looks like it's kind of corresponding to a single cell. Whether there's some mixing, I guess the way to say it is what's the threshold that you can say how much are you mixing signals? And we don't have a clear answer of that. Basically, what we can see is if we do a cross correlation, we pull out something that looks like a cell, and we don't pull out the next cell as well. I'd like to do that better though. That's interesting. The signals in individual pixels are probably not strong enough if you did that over multiple cells, you'd probably just pick the core. Yeah, you'd probably do that. Yeah, we have done that. Yeah, we should do that. We've been focusing on amacrin cells ITO traces in the array are actually a very good source of second harmonic generation, and when they generate an SHG signal, they tend to undergo some irreversible reaction that damages the array. So we've sort of tried to avoid. It doesn't mean it's impossible. I think that we just image the tops of the ganglion cells, and I think that we would be fine. There's lots of things that we could potentially do. Correlating with the electrical signal just to verify it. I think that's actually a very, very good idea. We can also measure signals from the inner plexiform layer. There's the potential that if you do the spike triggered average of the signal in the inner plexiform layer in the synapses, then we may be able to pull either synaptic inputs, or maybe we can pull out the dendrites of the ganglion cell itself. But this, starting with that is a good idea. In the salamander classes physiological classes right now are blurry. One of the reasons I mentioned that the fact that they split apart when you look at the adaptive features is because right now, there may be like 12 or 15 anatomical types, but what would you say a lot? Six or so functional types, or maybe eight, something like that. And the classes of cells, you think that they're... It changes you kind of identify classes when you have multiple cells of the same type in the same recording, and so the more electrodes you have, the more you'll get that. But I guess in our hands it doesn't get up to 12 or 15. So we don't think that we're more than anatomical types. We think that we're trying to catch up to the anatomical types, and we'd like to. You mean like which soma? No, we don't. And that's something that we could probably fairly easily identify optically. And one thing we'd like to do is fill the dendrites of ganglion cells that we record from the soma. And you can imagine optical techniques to do that. But currently we can't really do that. But by doing the spike triggered averaging of the soma, we could do that. Then we need some way to fill the dendrite, identify signal selectively from the dendrites of the cell that we're recording from. Is that where you were going? You were going beyond the soma, right?
I mean, the correlation between functional response and anatomy is a very tedious process to do this in a complex cell.
Yes.
Yeah. So you have so much somata identified, then of course you could take that to
the GDM. Oh, of course, right. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, no, that's definitely a good approach. We tend to do lots of things without histology, and so you know that means that we're sort of we have an agnosia maybe when it comes to that approach. But yeah, so I think that we could probably in a fairly straightforward way identify the soma by sort of the spike triggered optical average, and then once we label the soma, then it would be not too hard to go back and trace the dendrites. Yeah, yeah. No, that's a very good approach.
In the case where you were reporting from the anatomy,
sometimes we fill when we're intracellular recording from we'll often do that, but not in every case, because it's sometimes when you record from a cell and inject current, then the dye it will take up afterwards is not so. It doesn't seem to survive. Well, that works better when you do a shorter experiment.